Tango Tango Papa 2023, September 23rd, 2018.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Checotah, Oklahoma. So I am still on the trip from Gilroy, California to Russellville, Arkansas. And so after that, I'll get to go home. So right now, I'm about roughly, let's say, 150 miles from Russellville. So I'll get there, I'm guessing maybe around noon, maybe possibly before. It just kind of really depends on when I leave here, because it's about 150 miles, as I say. And then it's about probably 100 miles or a little over 100 miles home and it should be a drop and hook in Russellville. So actually, this load that I have, in the last podcast I may have said onions, that I had a load of onions, but it's actually a load of garlic. And the garlic is pretty powerful. Onions, there's a similarity there, and I think garlic and onions probably are related, as far as I don't know if they're considered vegetables or if garlic or onions are considered vegetables. That maybe they are, maybe they aren't. That may be a bit of a misnomer, because I think onions in particular do end up getting put into the vegetable category, along with, like onions and tomatoes and what have you. And then the garlic is typically, people regard that as more of a spice. But they are, they do have some similarities if you look at them physically, because, of course, the onions are bigger and the garlic's quite a bit usually smaller. And, probably a little bit different structure of a plant, but they're both kind of a whitish color, like a off-white color, I guess you would say. So I think that there's some similarities, and there are actually some similarities in the way they smell, except the garlic is obviously much more powerful. And it's actually a good smell. Some people do not like the smell of onions, or they don't like the smell of garlic. Actually, I do, so it's really sort of an appetizing smell. But like I say, it is a little powerful, because I can smell it here in the truck even when I'm going down the road. Now, I think how that's happening, the reefer unit is running, it's a continuous run. They set on 34 degrees continuous run. So there's actually air coming out of the front or the bottom or somewhere, on the reefer unit. And that air is, at least in part, air that's been circulated in the trailer, because obviously the odor's coming through. And so even when I'm going down the road, now, of course, there's a gap between the tractor and the trailer, and so there's a bit of an air gap. And you'd think, there'd be a lot of wind blowing through there, and there's going to be some. However, obviously there's enough for that air that's coming out of the front, out of the reefer unit that's on the front of the trailer. There's enough air that is end up mixing with the air that is, because there are somewhere there are intake vents for the trailer, for the truck, to have the fresh air kind of a fresh air intake. And so that's how the smell is getting into the truck even when I'm driving down the road, the garlic smell. And sometimes it's more pronounced than it is others. So, I don't know. I smell it, and I'm sure that any truck that is parked beside me is going to smell it. And if there's any breeze at all, there are going to definitely be other people that are smelling the garlic. But it is, it's noticeable. It's quite, you just get close to the, walk up close to the truck and you can smell it. Kind of interesting. So, anyway, I should be getting home sometime tomorrow afternoon. And so, as I was saying in the last podcast, I need to, once I make it home, I need to really make a point of, if I can, either today or tomorrow of, tomorrow or the next day, of mowing the lawn, because after I have the doctor's appointment on the 26th, then I'm going to have to take it easy for, you know, the rest of the time that I'm home, and that means I'm not going to be able to just be out there bouncing around on the lawnmower, so, because I'm sure that would put kind of undue stress on those stitches in the middle of my back, in between my shoulder blades, that I'm going to end up having after the doctor visit. So the reason I'm making a podcast kind of so soon after the last one, it's been, day before yesterday, I think I made the podcast. I wanted to talk some more about consciousness and conscience. Because the two things are very much intertwined. Because, as I've said many times before, the modern idea, you know, and it's not a modern idea, really. The idea has been around for probably as long as there have been societies. There's been this idea, and I certainly had it, you know, and I've heard other people express it over and over again, so that our morals are, you know, sort of come from society, and they're just arbitrary, and they're just meant to kind of keep us in line and keep us as good slaves. I've often heard the argument, and somehow those morals, our parents managed to get those morals crammed into our head, and then we feel so guilty because we want to do this and we want to do that, and then we end up feeling guilty. And I contend that those morals are, for the most part, they're sort of built into us. They're, you can say they're latent. Sort of an, you can think of it as a kind of a latent ethics system. It doesn't dominate us, but when the idea is when we do something wrong, conscience is there to correct us, to remind, to tell us, hey, you're in error. You made an error. You made a mistake. So it's there to set us back, kind of, you know, push us back up on the rails. But of course, we end up making the mistake of resenting our conscience, which is a giant mistake, and then trying to drive a wedge between ourselves and our conscience. And then that leads us down the path. We'll find other people to help us drive those wedges. Other people that will agree with us that right is wrong and that wrong is right. And, but the problem is, with each one of those things that you do, each person that you find that agrees with you, the group that agrees with you, each distraction that you make use of, you know, you have your strategic distractions, you know, people, there's just constant distractions. Each time you do that, you're making your conscience bigger. And so therefore, that anxiety grows. Resentment is primarily how we, that's the primary vehicle that we as human beings use to attempt to play God in our own minds. And then, of course, the only alternative beyond resentment and beyond having other people agree with you that right is wrong and wrong is right, then, you know, what are you going to do? Oh, well, I'm going to be proud of what it turns me into. I'm going to develop a whole identity out of this resentment, whatever it was I resented. So, you know, whatever I was going to feel guilty about. So we're going to have a pride march. Kill your baby pride march. Or we're going to have a labor pride march. Because we're pissed off. We were born poor. We didn't ask to be born. We were born poor into this miserable world, and we have to work. And so we're resentful, and so we're just going to have we're going to be proud of being, you know, what the resentment's turned us into. So we're going to have a labor pride march. Or insert your own identity born of resentment pride march. Because there's other ones too that I won't go into that should be pretty damn obvious what I'm referring to. But there's other ones. And so all of those things that you do simply make your conscience worse, because you're not dealing with it. The longer you go without dealing with it directly, the worse it becomes. And then, once you commit the first sin, then it's easy to just keep piling new ones on. And again, let's just dust the word off sin. And what does that mean? To sin means to miss the mark. And we do that by resenting, and then we hold on to the resentment. The problem is that cuts you off from who you could have been, besides, you know, ending up with a guilty conscience. It cuts you off from who you could have been, sort of as an identity flowering out of what you see as a guilty conscience. If you're friends with your conscience, then you end up with an entire identity that sort of flourishes from that. But if you're enemies with your conscience, then not only are you guilty, but you're cut off from that. And then you end up with this external, sort of an externalized identity, a group identity. Where do you think groupthink comes from? It's also a cult. So you have to go along with whatever the groupthink is. You have to go along with the cultthink. And believe me, if the other cult members, the other people in your group, see you wavering, then they're very quick all they have to do is threaten to withdraw their support, or withdraw the group's support, to get the idea gets you to come back in line. When I say cult, I know some people have tried to take me to task and, oh, you have to, you know, you need to be more specific and look up the dictionary definition of cult, and it has to be a religious cult, blah, 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 blah. Well, no, it doesn't. you listen to this podcast at your own risk. I've said that a number of times, and it's true. You listen at your own risk. So it's my podcast. I set the rules. And so when I say cult, it could be a real religious cult, that, you know, sort of a traditional religious cult, or it could be the Apple cult, or it could be the Ford cult, or the Chevrolet cult. And there are cultic elements to all those things. They're sort of micro cults around any brand. You know, people say, "Oh, I'm passionate about the brand of this," or, you know, "the brand of my phone, I'm passionate about it." You know, "I'm passionate about Apple," or "I'm passionate about my Nikes." It's a cult. There are cultic elements to it. It's groupthink. But it's not limited to that. It's also in what you think of as traditional churches. There are cult-like aspects to it. Let's say you go to church on a regular basis. Let's say you've started going to church or whatever, and then all of a sudden, you know, maybe one Sunday, if you go to church on Sunday, because some churches go to church on Saturday, but let's say you miss church on Sunday. Maybe the first week goes by and then you miss it again the second time. Chances are good that somebody from the church is going to be calling you. "What's going on? We're concerned about you. How come you haven't been showing up at church?" They're trying to get you to come back. That's subtle pressure to get you to come back. So there are varying degrees of this sort of cult-based groupthink identity. And the more extreme version of that, and I'm thinking back, I don't even know if they're in existence anymore. Way, way back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, you would see these people, and they were, you know, the popular euphemism for them were Moonies. And so you would see these people sometimes in McDonald's. You know, they could just be anywhere. They could be in public, you know, like public areas, airport terminals, different places. You know, and a lot of times the businesses would sort of shoo them off. But they would be in pink, you know, kind of what I remember, sort of like pink robes, you know, the robe that would go kind of all the way to the ground. And they would ask for money. You know, so it was a South Korean, Sung Young Moon was the head of this church. So, you know, so-called church, but it was really a religious cult, you know, kind of an extreme one. So the way those work, you get these people, and invariably they were young people, maybe, you know, in their teens or their 20s. So you get these people, and you get them to do, you know, kind of as part of the indoctrination, get them to do something bad, like drink cow urine, or maybe eat feces, or something awful. Get them to do something bad, repugnant to their system. And of course, what that does, that creates, that sets up an immediate conflict with their conscience. A big immediate, you know, somebody gets you to eat feces, you're gonna end up with a conflict with your conscience. I guarantee you. And so then you end up with an automatic group allegiance, because in the group, you know, the group, quote unquote, you know, they would talk about love bombing the individual. You know, they'd have a love, what they'd call a love bomb, and they'd all, you know, kind of surround them and hug them or whatever. So, you know, you've done something wrong, something horrible, you've got a guilty conscience, then all of a sudden your allegiance is with the group, because the group is giving you support for helping you take your guilty conscience away, because you ate feces, for example, or you drank urine. And you're fine as long as the group is around. And if you begin to falter, all they have to do is just threaten to withdraw their support. And you're left with your guilty conscience. Now, an even more extreme version of that would be like a criminal gang. And there's plenty of criminal gangs where if you want to be in the gang, you want to be in the mafia or whatever, they make you commit a crime. You have to commit a burglary, robbery, maybe even a murder. Have to commit a murder, and then if you do and you can prove it, then you're in the group. And of course, the other gang members will love you then. And beyond that, then they also have the goods on you. They know you committed the murder and they can turn you in. Should you ever try to leave the mafia or try to leave their criminal gang. So it runs the entire range from what would be considered mild pressure, someone from the church calling you up, all the way up to they're going to threaten to turn you in to the cops because they know you committed the murder. Now, I always like to disarm myself. Whenever I talk about kids and parents and parents having kids and what have you and how to raise them, and I give my opinions, I always like to disarm myself, and I think I always manage to. I don't have any kids, never will have any kids, never been a parent, never will be a parent. However, that being said, I have opinions about it. So caution, you listen to this podcast, again, you're listening at your own risk. Listener beware. So let's imagine that you have a teenager. And the teenager, kind of gets in, they seem like a good kid and you get along with them fine, and then all of a sudden one day they come home from school and it's like they their allegiance is completely different, and they start sassing you back, and it's like, what's got into this person? What's got into my kid? And it's exactly the type of thing that I'm talking about. Maybe the other teenagers from the school, and it's usually from the school, I think, but the other teenagers, their other teenage friends, maybe they've talked them into, having premarital sex. Or they've talked them into doing some sort of drugs, marijuana or something worse. And of course, what's going to happen? Guilt. Guilty conscience. So who's their allegiance going to be with? Is it going to be with, you know, because they're going to think that you're going to, you know, you as the parent, even though you could be a very lousy example, you as the parent sort of represent the guilty conscience they're trying to run away from. And then they have their quote-unquote friends that maybe entice them into taking the drugs, smoking the marijuana, having the illicit premarital sex. Which one is going to give them sympathy? Which one is more likely to help drive a wedge between them and their conscience, their now guilty conscience? And so that's how, at least one way, that the allegiance, the child's allegiance to their parents, all of a sudden it just flips, it changes, and then, you know, what got into this child? And nobody talks about these things. Not in this way, you know. They'll talk all around it, and they talk about the pressures and the peer pressure and blah, 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 blah. But they never really talk about what goes on. And what goes on in our minds, you know, you can say it's complicated, but at the same time, it's really pretty simple. So in the last podcast, I was talking about consciousness. Sort of depending on conscience. Versus, you know, just, you could say, awareness. You know, so your dog is aware, you know, a fly, if there's a, you know, a fly flying around. Fly has some kind of an awareness, which is, you know, a pretty amazing thing. It's miraculous if you think about it. Little ant has an awareness. It's aware of threats. The fly has marvelous motion detection. The ant, you know, can kind of become aware if it's got a little bit of motion detection, but it's not as fast as the fly is. But they're simply aware of their environments. We as human beings have consciousness, and it's a different thing. Consciousness is very different from just awareness. Although awareness by itself is quite a miraculous thing. It's an amazing thing, even in an ant. So, we as human beings have this extra awareness. It's awareness, really, of our own existence. And it's an awareness of our own mortality. And, you know, there's plenty of people that argue that to be a human being means you suffer. And I think that's sort of a traditional church view. that existence as a human being means suffering. But why would that be? Why would God create a creature that would simply be born directly into suffering without a choice on his or her part? And the answer is he didn't. The reason that we suffer is because we end up getting tricked into corrupting our own awareness. And it always happens when we're kids, and it's usually our parents, because our parents are typically the first people that we encounter. Kids tend to look at their parents as if they're gods, as I've said many times. And the parents invariably fail them. And even if the parents were perfect, we as human beings, when we come into this world, we have a proclivity to want to play God. It's right in the book of Genesis. It's right in the Adam and Eve story. Man wanted to be as God. Adam wanted to be as God. So I believe that you could have perfect parents, and the kid's still going to end up resenting the parents. Going to find something to resent. But oftentimes we're tricked into it. Because we're pretty innocent. You know, it's about as close to innocent as you can get when you come into this world. And then you resent your parents for whatever reason. They did something. Maybe they did it deliberately. Maybe they did it. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they weren't even aware of it, that they slighted you in some way. Because remember, the idea of being born in sin, we all have this sort of a dark side to us, a potential dark side, a malicious side. And often we're not aware of it. We do things and we're not aware. Other people can see us doing things and we're not aware. Resentment comes packaged with its own denial mechanism. Resentment also causes us to be compulsive. You end up, as a parent, sort of doing unto your child as it was done unto you. You're under a sort of a compulsive eye for an eye type system, to varying degrees. So we come into the world, we resent our parents, because typically they're the first people we encounter. And then it snowballs from there. Once you've resented, and then you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and you have an ever more guilty conscience. Your identity, which could have come from a conscience, could have flowered out of a conscience, of the thing that you know of as guilty conscience, it could have flowered, if you were friends with that conscience, your consciousness would have flourished right out of that. A magnificent awareness, the likes of which we can only imagine, could come from that. The likes of which the world's probably rarely seen. But we're cut off from it, and we have our resentment and what have you, and that's just part of life. But, you know, because as I've said before, as I've explained before, you know, I believe we come into this world and, you know, we are born in sin, and so the sin is going to end up infecting us, and there's about 100% chance that that's going to happen. And we can live our lives for a season in sin and kind of find out where sin goes and that it doesn't work. And then some of us, and it's a mystery as to why, but some of us are sort of really sensitive to it, and we're looking for a way. We're looking for salvation is what we're really looking for. We're looking for the truth. And we won't give up until we find it. But consciousness separated from conscience is corrupted. It sort of becomes a different thing. Sort of supported by the groupthink. And that's where the suffering comes from. And people think, well, you know, I suffer because of this or because of that, or this person died or that person died, or this happened or that happened, or, you know, whatever. People, you know, think that's their suffering. And the suffering, you know, things happen. Stuff happens. If you have the right relationship with conscience, then the stuff that happens, you know, it might be a little sad, or, you know, it could be inconvenient. You may or may not like it. It may or may not be enjoyable. But it doesn't rise to the level of suffering. What we're really suffering when stuff happens to you, and you're a normal average person, you're sort of separated from your conscience, you've got a guilty conscience, and you tend to, you know, find your friends that help you see wrong is right and right is wrong, and you've got all your distractions. You think you're normal. Well, I'm normal. Everybody does it, is how we think. You're one of those people, and then, you know, let's say somebody dies, or you get fired, or this happens or that happens, and you think, my God, I'm suffering. What's causing you to suffer? You think it's just because whatever it was happened, that's causing you to suffer? No, what's causing you the real suffering is happening because you don't have an anchor. You don't have a solid foundation for the sort of the house of your ego. Which would be, if you're friends with your conscience, then, you know, this stuff can happen, people can die, you know, this can happen, that can happen. But as long as you have the relationship the proper relationship is with your conscience, as long as you're friends with your conscience. You may not like it when this happens or that happens, but there's no suffering. It's almost like, you know, someone else is suffering. You know, even though, you know, you might know it's you that's going through whatever it is, but there's a huge difference between if you're enemies with your conscience versus being friends with your conscience. Because if you're friends with your conscience, it sort of changes everything. And so being friends with your conscience, having your consciousness flower out of conscience, is that's really the way we are designed as human beings to function. People say, you know, the people that argue that conscience is just set, the parameters are set somehow by, you know, quote unquote society, wherever it is. The society, put that in quotations, it does not exist. It's just, you know, I'm an individual, you're an individual, we're all individuals. Really, what you should, if you want to be more accurate, you could try to say, well, the mob is setting my, the groupthink mob is setting my moral standards. But that doesn't really work, does it? Doesn't work so well. Because if your groupthink mob, usually they'll enable you. They'll tell you, oh, it's really good. Yeah, it's really good to, you know, have the premarital sex. You know, we'll all have drinks, falling down drunk, or whatever it is that you do. You know, and if that, you know, your groupthink mob then tries to set moral standards. Well, it's, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. It's really bad that you're doing whatever, you know, some of them do try to set moral standards. You know, and what I'm thinking of is some of the social justice warrior garbage that goes on. That's a mob. It's kind of a groupthink mob. And so they do try to, you know, they'll, you know, they think they have these moral standards. Of course, they're, you know, they're backwards. And then if one of them, they think one of them violates it, then of course what do? Because it's a cult, then they withdraw support or they may try to ridicule them or whatever. But do they really feel guilty? The person that violates those rules, the groupthink mob rules, do the people feel guilty over it? Of course not. Real conscience is not programmed from society. It's built into our biology. I was listening to something earlier today, and the guy was talking about rats. Studies with rats. So you can take a big bully rat and then a smaller rat, and kind of lock them in a cage together. You know, and I'm assuming you feed them and what have you. You know, they have plenty of food and water. But you got a kind of a more aggressive, bigger rat and a smaller, you know, kind of more timid rat. And the more timid rat will try to initiate play with the big bully rat. But after a while, and this is a consistent statistic, after a while, if the big bully rat won't play, you know, kind of have a little play session, you know, where they sort of play fight, and allow that the smaller, less aggressive rat to win, if he, at least 30% of the time, as long as the bigger rat, the more aggressive rat, allows the smaller rat that initiates the play, the rat play session, as long as he or she lets the smaller rat win at least 30% of the time, then the smaller rat will continue to initiate those play sessions. However, if the bigger rat, the more aggressive rat, won't let the smaller rat win at least 30% of the time, this is repeatable, then the smaller rat stops. The smaller rat stops initiating the play session. What does that say? There's even morality that emerges from rats. Isn't that interesting? So how much more is that true then for human beings? Of course we have morals. Of course they're built in. So, conscience is a fundamental part. It's actually unified with consciousness. And unless you're some sort of a psychopath, sociopath, like the Clintons come to mind. Unless you're one of those, and those are pretty rare, really. Jeffrey Dahmer would be another one. There are plenty of them, but they're fairly rare. Relatively speaking. Unless you're one of those, you know, you're sort of born with this, you know, with a brain defect, or with a, you know, it's a defect of some sort. Unless you're one of those people, then you know the difference between right and wrong. You know, you go into prison, you know, and those people in the prison, they know the difference between right and wrong. You know, even you find some guy that's done all kinds of burglaries or whatever it is, and they know. They know they did wrong. So much as you want to drive a wedge, you know, you just love to just, if you could just amputate, you know, go to the doctor and say, amputate my conscience. I don't want a conscience anymore. Get rid of it. As much as people would like to do that, find your group that gives you the love bomb. B-O-M-B, bomb. Bang. Unless you can find that, you know, you can do that all you want, but you still have that conscience. It is still there. You can't, you know, it's probably next to impossible to kill it, because it's an intrinsic part of consciousness. And it could really be argued that it's kind of the same thing. One thing sort of comes out of the other. And so we do have to suffer. There's a certain amount of suffering that we have to do. And that may vary from one person to the next. No, you know, people are different from each other. But there is a certain amount of suffering that we have to suffer. And suffering is one of those things that can cause, you know, in some mysterious ways, it can cause some of us to want to wake up. Some of us to want to find the real truth. And, you know, I think a lot of people they're just hoping against hope that they're going to find out that they're the truth. Of course, you know, you believe that you're, you know, what a fantasy. You wake up one day and you think, oh, I'll wake up and I'm going to realize that I'm God. Sorry, you're not. That's the problem with human, you know, it's a nature of consciousness. The nature of our consciousness is, you know, we're sort of a chip off the old block, as it were. But you can argue, does it come out of biology? You can make a convincing argument that morals sort of emerge from biology to a certain extent. You know, if we're going to be able to live together. And not kill each other off. I personally believe it goes beyond that. Goes into the realm of mind. And I really do believe that there's a lot about consciousness, the brain, how the brain functions. There's just an awful lot that we have no clue about. We don't know how it works. You know, people are working on these problems every day, you know, about, you know, neurons firing and what have you. But it's pretty clear to me that the human brain is complicated far beyond that. Far beyond simply neurons, you know, all these neurons kind of firing. And somehow consciousness arises from that. You know, and as I've said before, that's sort of the people that believe that you just have enough computer, like you're going to try to create your artificial intelligence and you have enough computing power and you structure it in the right way and somehow it's like a cargo cult. The consciousness is just magically going to emerge from that. It's going to arise if you just have the right neuron, enough computer, you know, the software sort of mimicking the neurons in the human brain, that and you get kind of organized right, that consciousness is just going to emerge from that. And that's a cargo cult. That's just a modern cargo cult. Sorry. In a way, atheists, people that are, you know, the rabid atheists in particular it's a cargo cult. Stuff just didn't happen. How did the dust become aware of itself? And they like to, you know, say, well, you know, they believe in emergence. You know, so you have the ant colony. They love to talk about that. You know, you have individual ant, and it just kind of goes around in circles. You know, and you have your ant, sort of ant columns, and they behave in certain ways, and you got different sort of different segments of the ant society, and then they have their giant ant hive, you know, of various sizes. But, you know, and then when they have their ant hive, you know, there's like these ants. I've watched these documentaries before, these ants in Africa somewhere. They build this giant hive, and you know, it's got ventilation shafts, and it's actually fairly sophisticated. Built in the dirt, built kind of partially under the ground. And partially above the ground in a mound. Giant ant mound. And so they love, you know, these people love to study it. They say, oh, it's an emergent behavior. It's just, you can have the individual ant, and we don't know, you know, they just kind of run around or whatever. But somehow you get a big group of them, and somehow they all know how to build their ant city. And they actually, there's ant farmers, so they actually are able to do some farming, to farm some of their food, and they actually make ventilation shafts to get rid of the excess heat. Does that just happen? Well, let's be honest. Does that just happen? No. It doesn't just happen. We're talking about ants, let alone human beings, let alone human consciousness. By the way, the cargo cult, as I mentioned before, you can look them up. I think World War I or probably World War II, there were some planes that were dropping supplies, boxes of supplies, probably wooden crates of supplies, on tropical islands. I believe it was in the South Pacific somewhere. And so sometimes they would drop it on these islands, and, you know, so these natives they kind of made a religion out of it for whatever reason, and so they sort of build their little mock airports and wait for the planes to come and drop the crates of supplies. Wait for the manna from heaven. There's actually a video you can watch on YouTube. It was part of a documentary, sort of, you know, actually showing these people do it, you know, these natives. You know, with their bamboo mock control towers. Cargo cult. Isn't it amazing what human beings can make a cult out of? Anything, literally anything under the sun. There is nothing new under the sun, says the Bible, and it's absolutely true. There is nothing new. You think you're unique? You think you've got unique thoughts? You believe you're the first person that ever thought this or thought that? Wrong. So getting kind of back to the point, you know, suffering. Why do we suffer? We suffer not because things happen, as we like to believe and we like to blame. We suffer because we're perceiving the world, we're perceiving existence in the wrong way. Part of something is missing, a fundamental part of us, of our sort of our perception system is missing, kind of missing in action. Because, well, I don't, we build a drive a wedge. We didn't want that part of it. We didn't want that part. It made me feel guilty. I don't want that part. So that's why we suffer. Because we have sort of been tricked into corrupting our own perception system. And that's why you have this, you know, people say that they have a kind of an empty feeling. Well, there's your reason. You have no purpose in life. What's your purpose in life? If you're separated from your conscience, how's your character going to develop? You know, it's probably going to develop in a weird way. 100% chance it will. You know, you could end up being a so-called social justice warrior with these, you know, weird you know, sort of a weird way of looking at the world. Or perhaps an angry feminist. Or, you know, an angry black person. Who really ends up with a double whammy, because not only are they, you know, they have the resentment kind of put into them. They got the normal resentment, if you want to call it normal, of failing parents, looking at the kids, looking at the parents as if they're gods, and then the gods fail them. And they get the double whammy that they have to resent the world around them, the white man is beating them down or whatever, and they have to resent that because if they don't, they're going to call them, well, you're Uncle Tom, or you're an Oreo, white on the inside, black on the outside, etc., etc. So their so-called race, unfortunately, tends to be its own cult. Because of resentment, and they end up with an externalized identity. It's horrible. So it adds to their suffering. Every resentment that you have, every denial that you make, so that you don't have to face your conscience, every one of those makes your suffering worse. Because without that foundation of being friends with your conscience, you know, and I'm using the word conscience. You could there are other words that you could use. You know, there's a Greek concept of logos, which works. Same kind of idea, I believe. But as long as you're separated from that, you can never be right. There's always an emptiness. And that is the source of suffering. You know, but we want to blame, oh, well, this happened, or that happened, or this person died, or that person died, or whatever, you know, there's a million different things that people come up with. And they all agree, oh, well, we all agree that this is the cause of suffering. No, that's not. Sorry. The cause of suffering is you have sort of a misguided, malformed, corrupted perception of the world. You as a conscious being, as with a consciousness, not just awareness, but consciousness. Consciousness without conscience, without sort of being unified as one unit. Consciousness is going to suffer. If one unit, if you're friends with your conscience, the suffering goes away. It's as simple as that. Does that mean that you suddenly become perfect? No. Does that mean that nothing ever goes wrong? No. You still going to have to work? Yes. Could you get sick? Yes. Could somebody close to you die? Absolutely, they will. The difference is, you don't suffer. That doesn't mean that you have to like whatever it is that happened. That doesn't mean that something isn't going to be unpleasant. But Or conversely, it may mean, you know, that doesn't mean that things won't be pleasant. Life is life. Life goes on. Existence happens. Time passes. The root of suffering is separation from conscience. And, you know, you can argue, you know, some people, if, you know, because you have different types of atheists. You have the rabid ones that want to get rid of conscience at all costs. And I think that's kind of the driving force behind their religious fervor atheism, their cult of atheism. I mean, it's its own cult. And then you have the other people that there are people that simply don't know. And, you know, some of those people are actually kind of honest. They're sort of rare, but they're out there. And those type of people, you know, there's a type of person that I have in mind that maybe they don't believe. Fine. Doesn't matter. If you relate to conscience in the right way, whether you have the words or not, if you relate to conscience in the right way and you sort of live your life out of that, and you sort of build your identity out of that, it literally doesn't matter whether you say you believe or you don't believe. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing. A rose by any other name is still a rose, says William Shakespeare. So, anyway, better be cutting this off. We're about, what, an hour, 11 minutes, something like that. So, anyhow, hope everyone has had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.